off another meeting of the New York State Climate Action Council. As you may have heard, Governor Cuomo lifted the state of emergency that was in place to protect us from COVID-19. And so we are pleased to start welcoming the public back to the CAC. In accordance with federal CDC guidelines, fully vaccinated individuals do not need to wear masks or be socially distanced, but we kindly ask the unvaccinated or unknown status individuals wear masks and maintain 6 feet social distance. The CAC members and others have planned and prepared for a virtual meeting, and we recognize it's a little difficult to rearrange schedules on such short notice. So thank you for those that were able to rearrange their schedules and be here today. We were also holding today's meeting via webinar to enable broader participation across the state. And for future meetings, we'll be sure to provide adequate notice to ensure participation from those desiring to join the meetings in person. And so before we get started, I'm just going to kick it over to Sarah Anderson to walk us through the procedures for today's meeting.
Great. Thanks, all. And I think that the meeting procedures will be a bit of a hybrid for what Sarah just was describing about our in-person and kind of hybrid approach with some folks joining online. So for those who have joined virtually, and for those sitting close to the microphones in the room, please remember to be on mute if you're not speaking. And if you are speaking, feel free to just mute and unmute yourself so that you are in control. For those joining virtually, we do encourage video for CDC members, particularly if you're speaking, and encourage you to use the hand raise button, which you can find as indicated on the screen, so that the co-chairs can call on you individually, at which time you can unmute yourself. If you do have any technical problems, please feel free to contact the email address that's at the bottom left of the screen right now, nys.cac@cabinetsgroup.com, so that we can help you out. And otherwise, those in the rooms, you should be able to speak as a regular meeting would allow. So thank you all, and I will pass back to Sarah and the co-chairs.
Thank you. This is Rain Harris. So let's turn to calling the roll to see which members of the council are in attendance today. The council's secretary, Valerie Milanovich, is on vacation. So in her stead, we have designated Lisa Covert to call the roll for the day. So, Lisa, would you call the roll, please?
Thank you, Doreen. Good afternoon, council members and designees. When I call your name, please acknowledge your participation in today's Climate Action Council meeting. I note the attendance of co-chair Doreen Harris in person in Albany. Also in person in Albany, co-chair Sagos.
Present.
Commissioner Ball.
Present.
Commissioner Dominguez.
Present.
Gavin Donahue.
Present.
Chair Howard.
I'm present.
On behalf of Commissioner Reardon, Yvonne Martinez.
Present.
Ann Reynolds.
Here.
On behalf of Secretary Rosado, Sarah Crowell.
Present.
On behalf of Commissioner Zucker, Henry Sleetock.
Present.
In person in New York City, on behalf of President Gertler, Kevin Hansen.
Present.
Attending here. Remotely. Donna DeCarolis.
I'm here.
Dennis Elsenbeck.
Here.
On behalf of CEO Falcone, Rick Shansky. We'll circle back to Rick. Bob Howarth.
I'm here remotely.
Peter Iwanowitz.
Peter Iwanowitz is here, yes.
Raya Salter.
Present.
Paul Shepson.
I am here remotely.
Commissioner Visnoskis.
Here.
Chancellor Malatras.
Present.
CEO Quinones.
Present.
And Rose Harvey.
Present.
Given that, council co-chairs, we do not have an in-person quorum for today's Fun Action Council meeting.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you all for making it in person for those who could. Certainly appreciate your quick work to do so. So our agenda today would typically begin with consideration of the minutes of the last meeting on June 8th, but given, as Lisa reported, that we do not have a quorum, we will do so at our next council meeting. So instead, we are going to turn immediately to our primary agenda item, which is a focused discussion from the Climate Justice Working Group, affording them the opportunity to provide input and feedback to the council on a climate justice framework and the recommendations advanced by the Transportation and Housing and Energy Efficiency panels. And so if we move forward two slides past the minutes, I will turn the presentation over to Commissioner Sagos to kick off that discussion.
Thank you, Doreen. It's good to be back in person with some of you. First time in a very long time. Looking forward to making this a permanent thing. And certainly, I'll echo your welcome to the Climate Justice Working Group. I'm glad that you all are on. As you all know, the consultation with the Climate Justice Working Group is an essential part of our work here on the CAC. As we begin to take these recommendations and craft a draft scoping plan, and I think I can speak on behalf of all of you, that we are entirely and deeply committed to ensuring that justice and equity is a part of every single action that we take as a CAC and certainly the product that we generate. So each advisory panel has had representation from community-based environmental justice organizations. That is a good start. And the process has worked thus far, but we now take this to the next level. The council today and from now for the next several months will be taking input directly from the Climate Justice Working Group to inform the development of our scoping plan. The working group, as Doreen mentioned, will provide us with that framework to guide our decision-making over the coming months, and we'll begin providing feedback directly on several of the advisory panels. So today we're going to hear about transportation, housing and energy efficiency advisory panels and the work that the Climate Justice Working Group has done on those panels. We'll then get a brief update from the chair of the Climate Justice Working Group, that's Rosa Mendez from DEC. And then we will we'll hear from Rosa on the process forward on how we're turning some of the group's progress into the definition of disadvantaged communities, which is going to be going out of public comment this summer. At subsequent meetings, we'll hear feedback in regards to the other panels that have presented. Good. Okay. So, assuming that Elizabeth Yampierre is on, I would like to welcome her. Elizabeth is the Executive Director of UPROSE, and she will be presenting the Climate Justice Framework. Elizabeth, good afternoon.
Ashe, buenas tardes, good afternoon. It's great to see you. Do you want me to begin now?
Please do.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if you can put up a slide of the Just Transition Framework. Thank you. So thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I'm honored to be here with my colleagues from the Climate Justice Working Group. And as was mentioned, I'm the executive director of UPROSE, which is Brooklyn's oldest Latino community-based organization working at the intersection of racial justice and climate change, also a member of New York Renews and the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance, and co-chair of the board of directors of the Climate Justice Alliance, which is a national organization of frontline leaders from all over the country looking to operationalize a just transition. Just recently, we learned that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is preparing a landmark report that has been leaked and warns of a series of thresholds beyond which recovery from climate breakdown may become impossible. It warns that life on Earth can recover from a drastic climate shift by evolving into new species and creating new ecosystems, but humans cannot. And this is what is before us today. So this begs the question, what is environmental justice? And the definition of environmental justice and the framework comes from a movement, just like environmental justice, climate justice, just transition. These are terms that have been defined by a movement and not open to redefinitions or water or even the possibility of watering down justice. Climate justice operates at the intersection of racial and social rights, environmental and economic justice. It focuses on the root causes of climate change and calls for transformation to a just, sustainable, community-led economy. Like resource rights, climate justice also means that those most impacted offer the most effective solutions. For our frontline communities, the solution starts with defending land and rivers from mines, power plants, mega projects, and industrial agriculture, and expanding agroecology, transformative economies, and building community-controlled energy and food systems. Just this week, we're seeing heat waves across the Pacific Northwest, warnings for earlier hurricane season, the continued fight for clean air, water, and food as a right and not a privilege as enjoyed by those who can afford it. We're in a moment of deep reckoning. Like climate change, the conditions of our communities are the consequence of a long history of extraction. We share legacies of fighting colonialism as well as race, class, and gender oppression while advocating for environmental justice. And we share vision, values, and principles that guide our environmental, economic, and social justice organizing. Our communities are the first and most impacted by the storms, fires, floods, and droughts, and are disproportionately burdened by the pollution, poverty, and systemic violence associated with multinational corporations driving these ecological crises. Consequently, the recommendations that come out of our respective working groups must reflect the moment that we're in. And we can't afford to have siloed recommendations or any type of recommendations that may perpetuate or cause additional harm to disadvantaged communities. We know that climate change exacerbates racial injustice. And if it does that, if this body does that, then it's not climate justice. Achieving the state's climate goals will require true systems level change. And some of the panel recommended, as some of the panel recommendations point out, does the CAC have a framework for understanding what systems change means and requires? If not, perhaps you should consider the FSG's water of systems change model, or look at this table that is in front of you, which is a just transition model that was created by frontline leadership all over the country. This graphic is what we think defines a just transition. The scoping plan should include clear guidance for how benefits and investments will be defined, measured, tracked, and shared over the long term. NYSERDA seems to be doing a good job of developing a system for ensuring that benefits and investments are properly distributed, but that system should be codified so that high standards are maintained over the long term. This should include clear guidance on whether the 35 to 40% target is in addition to current programs and spending, or whether it includes current programs and spending. Ideally, it should be additive. How communities are engaged in identifying and implementing local investment opportunities. What role will residents play in deciding what investments should be prioritized? The process must be community-driven. What happens if the benefits if the benefit target is not achieved over a given time frame? Should it be assessed annually? For example, should state agencies be required to retroactively meet the 35 to 40% goal for investments that weren't made since the CLCPA passed? Ideally, yes. What happens if an investment doesn't produce the anticipated benefit? What's the expectation for how information about benefits or investments will be publicly shared? How are the panels accounting for the social cost of carbon and co-pollutants? Workforce development efforts should prioritize and target low-income communities of color, disadvantaged residents across sectors, and must honor the principles of a just transition. Different regions have different needs, and identifying those needs can only happen at the local level. And this is why the process must be community driven. There are holes in the data that we are currently working with. So better data will be needed to accurately measure the success of the CLCPA's implementation, including the impact on disadvantaged communities over the short and long term. We know that it is an enormous amount of work, but it is precedent-setting work, and how it is delivered will be will show us whether there is a commitment from the CAC to address root causes, to address the legacy of extraction in communities of color, and whether or not the recommendations are centered in racial justice and equity. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I'll move on to the next member of our panel.
So I think that's where I take over. I'm Abby McHugh Griffa. I'm the executive director of the Climate Solutions Accelerator up here in the Genesee Finger Lakes region, or in other words, known as the Rochester area. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today and for the important work that the Climate Action Council is doing. So to frame up my remarks here, I'm going to start with an overview of our comments and concerns on the transportation panel recommendations, and then go to the slides themselves. And you'll see here, even on this first slide, that some of what's here reflects what Elizabeth was just saying, some of our more overarching concerns that apply to all the panel recommendations. As we move on with the slides, my colleague Eddie Bautista will cover some of the material. But I do want you to be aware that what's on the slides is not a complete summary of our feedback. We do have more detailed comments and concerns that we would be happy to share in writing. Also, please feel free to interrupt me at any time. I can't really see most of you and not looking at the chat. So if you do have something to say, feel free to just interrupt me. I would be perfectly happy to that. We'd love to have a real dialogue with you. So again, feel free to interject with comments or questions at any time. So to frame up what you can expect from this next portion of our presentation, we are going to be talking about the transportation panel recommendations and the energy efficiency and housing panel recommendations. And the reason we chose those two is because we feel that they represent opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of how well the panels incorporated environmental justice priorities and really thought through the details of how these strategies would impact disadvantaged communities. So of all of the panel recommendation, there's quite a range in terms of how integrated these environmental justice concerns are and how effective we think the strategies will be to address environmental justice concerns. And so we're using these two today to highlight the extremes. The Energy Efficiency and Housing Panel, we feel overall did an excellent job of thinking this through, of explaining their recommendations in a way that is accessible and that can really allow communities to understand and respond to the recommendations. And the transportation panel's recommendations, we had some serious concerns about, and overall we feel that they have fallen short. So again, using these to illustrate the two extremes. So digging into the transportation panel, one of our primary concerns was a general lack of clarity and detail in the slides that made it hard to thoroughly understand the recommended strategies and their impact on disadvantaged communities. Whereas the Energy and Efficiency and Housing Panel provided a definition of key terms and acronyms, the transportation panel's recommendations are full of jargon and vague or squishy language. This kind of language prohibits the general public from meaningfully engaging in this important process, which in itself is problematic from an environmental justice perspective. I'm going to give you a few concrete examples of what I mean by, vague or squishy language. So on slide 20 of the transportation panel's recommendations, it says, enhance service availability, accessibility, and affordability. But it provides zero detail about how that should be accomplished. On the same slide, it says, make ready costs for service facilities. I've been doing this work for a while, and I just simply don't understand what that means. It says, utility rate design changes. This is probably a good idea, but because of the lack of detail, it's just hard to say. What kind of rate changes are these? Rate changes could be really excellent, but again, we need more detail, we need more clarity on what exactly the transportation panel is suggesting. Also, in terms of vague, squishy language and lack of detail, there were three problematic themes that we identified. The first is that the recommendations focus on encouraging and incentivizing behaviors rather than on concrete enforceable policy change that will advance the systemic transformation of our transportation system that the climate crisis demands. Similarly, we felt there was a lack of data and clear accountable goals. To achieve the emissions reduction targets of the CLCPA, we will need real metrics to measure progress, as Elizabeth mentioned earlier, coupled with effective enforcement mechanisms. It is unclear that the transportation panel's recommended strategies would meet the state's decarbonization goals. The panel's commitment to public engagement and community-led decision-making process also appears to be somewhat inauthentic or at least insufficient. For example, on three slides, it does say engage communities in decision-making. That is listed as an anticipated impact or benefit for disadvantaged communities. But there is no explanation of how that engagement will occur or how the input will be used. In addition, a list of key stakeholders is provided for each strategy, but only two of these lists, out of many lists, include groups that directly represent EJ concerns. It's especially problematic that EJ groups and community members aren't included as key stakeholders on the planning and collaboration slide. So authentic community engagement in decision-making processes is important across sectors, and we strongly encourage, as Elizabeth mentioned, the Climate Action Council to emphasize this in the final scoping plan. But community engagement and local decision-making are especially important in the transportation sector because regional differences in this sector are so pronounced. What makes sense for New York City is different from what makes sense for the Rochester region, which is going to be different than what makes sense for the Adirondacks. So because local needs can only be accurately defined at the local level, the process of restructuring the transportation system absolutely must be community driven. For example, as a representative of the Rochester region, I was alarmed by the relative lack of emphasis in the panel recommendations on improving public transportation as compared to other strategies. Our current public transit system is woefully inadequate, and doubling the service, as recommended on slide 16, would still be inadequate. So from my perspective, the recommendation to, quote, double the service availability accessibility of municipally sponsored upstate and downstate suburban public transportation services statewide seems both arbitrary and weirdly focused on suburban communities. Slide 20 does mention enhancing service for rural and urban areas as a benefit for disadvantaged communities, but since that isn't included in the initiative description on slide 16, it's unclear how the proposed strategies would meet those needs. So again, this gets back to where the language in the slides themselves, it's just very difficult to follow and understand and assess whether the strategies would have the intended impact. As climate conditions worsen, we in our region anticipate that we'll see an increase of climate migrants and refugees that move to our area from other parts of the state and country. There's no indication that the transportation panel has taken these kinds of population shifts into account or is considering how the transportation needs in any given region may change over the coming decades. Though we all agree that electrification of the transportation system is a key priority, for a region like ours, overemphasizing investment in electrification at the expense of investment in public transportation and transit-oriented development could easily exacerbate existing inequalities. Increasing reliance on single occupancy vehicles would simply not be beneficial for our region. So bold strategies to reduce vehicle miles traveled must be a top priority here in Rochester region and elsewhere. As I'm sure you're aware, car ownership is expensive. It's also highly correlated with income. So even if an LMI household was given an electric car at no cost, that household would still be burdened with the cost of charging, infrastructure, registration, and maintenance. These costs could easily top 10% of an LMI household's income and significantly outstrip the cost of using public transit. In addition, increasing spending on public transit would create well-paid, often unionized jobs to local communities that have been harmed by decades of disinvestment. Little education education is needed to train people for these jobs, offering opportunities for economic security and mobility to disadvantaged workers. Furthermore, salaries paid to these workers largely stay within local communities and the state. This is also the case for investing in local development and transit-oriented development. In contrast, the majority of money spent on electric cars instantly leaves the New York State economy. Finally, we are concerned by the lack of strategies that improve access between regions, especially considering that not everyone owns a car. There was no mention of high-speed rail or improvements to bus and rail services between regions. If people can't get from one place to another without a car, electric or otherwise, New York State's transportation system will not be just or environmentally sustainable. So I'm going to pause there to see if there are any questions, and then I'll take a specific tour through with you on these slides. But any questions at this point?
We had agreed, Abigail, to take the questions at the end so that, can get through all the panels.
Okay. Thanks, Elizabeth. Okay, so again, this first slide here, you'll see that there's some overlap between a lot of what Elizabeth mentioned, sort of these overarching observations and concerns, and the transportation-specific concerns. So recognizing that goals, benchmarks, and accountability are essential, and that the recommendations need clear guidance, so within the Climate Action Council scoping plan, on how benefits and investments will be defined, measured, and tracked, and shared over the long term. Scoping plan must ensure data is available to accurately measure the success of implementing the CLCPA. In terms of scrutinizing every action for justice, some of the recommendations presented false market-based solutions, and in just a moment, Eddie will speak more about that, so I will leave it there. Providing greater clarity, reasoning, and purpose. So again, as I mentioned, the target of doubling municipally sponsored public transit seems somewhat arbitrary without an analysis on, the slides just don't make it clear. What is that doubling based on? Where did that number come from? Policies with significant implications, like a fee bait, deserve more than a hand wave. So again, details, clarity, providing some better description, more comprehensive description of what that actually looks like, how that works in practice, and how it would affect disadvantaged communities. Providing explanation as how the social cost of carbon was incorporated, and editing jargon to make the language easier to interpret. In terms of the ambition, again, we felt that the transportation panel recommendations, it was just not clear that they will meet the greenhouse gas emissions reductions laid out in the CLCPA. So in terms of filling the gap of connectivity between regions that rely on public transportation, thinking about high-speed rail, long-range bus services, other strategies like that, would love to see some information in the transportation panel slides about that. Refining the transit-oriented development strategy to elevate estimated greenhouse gas emission reduction impact by 2050 from medium to high, by placing the most emphasis on reducing vehicle miles traveled. And then again, just some caution, while we all recognize that electrification is extremely important, making sure that single occupancy vehicles our reliance on them is not increased. And so thinking about how the balance of strategies allows for people to get around their communities without access to a single occupancy vehicle. And so this hinders our ability to address the root causes of runaway transportation emissions and its related link to systemic issues such as racism and poverty. And I'm going to pass it to Eddie, who's going to take the next slide here.
Thanks, Abby. I'm Eddie Bautista. I'm the executive director of the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance. I'm going to be covering some of the critique that we had regarding the Transportation and Climate Initiative. You'll see from the slides that some of the points that we wanted to make include, let's lead with the overall antipathy that climate justice and environmental justice communities and leaders across the country have when it comes to market-based solutions. Best available evidence shows that cap-and-trade systems do not eliminate air pollution hotspots and often exacerbate them. For example, there was a 2018 peer-reviewed academic paper put out by the Public Library of Science that shows that after the implementation of cap and trade, California's in-state emissions actually increased between 2011 and 2015. More than half of the regulated facilities reported higher in-state emissions under cap and trade, and the communities subjected to increasing emissions were home to higher proportions of people of color and low-income households compared to communities that enjoyed emissions reductions. So just to start, not only has cap and trade as a system, we have at least a recent academic paper that shows that there were increases, but in fact, there were increases specifically when it came to overburdened communities of color, as opposed to where there had been maybe some regional air emissions reductions in majority white communities and higher income communities. So in terms of just from a market-based perspective, we've never looked at market-based strategies or schemes as a way to reduce emissions, but rather maybe to generate revenues. Which brings us to the next point. Like the regional greenhouse gas emissions, funds that will be generated by TCI, by the Transportation Climate Initiative, would be vulnerable to budgetary raids by the executive and legislative branches. To date, there has been absolutely no ability by TCI proponents to demonstrate how these funds would be protected. So not only is cap and trade is as applied to the transportation sector, not something that would reduce revenue, would reduce emissions, but in fact the revenues generated aren't even there's not a way to protect and commit the investment of those dollars. Reforms to cap and trade are also unlikely to reduce pollution disparities, given the program's inability to surgically reduce mobile source emissions, which are more complex to regulate than stationary sources. Some of our members in the South Bronx talk about how their communities is, quote unquote, in the triangle of death because they are ringed by the Cross Bronx Expressway, the Bruckner, the Sheridan. Literally, you have communities with thousands of people that are surrounded by highways, and these are the kind of mobile source emissions that it's that these types of initiatives like TCI have not been able to demonstrate the ability to reduce those emissions. Also, the inherent design flaws of cap and trade result in environmental racism. Let me give you a specific example. Diesel emissions are among the more disproportionately harmful to our communities, again, given the access to major highways that are ringing many of our communities. And one of the things that we discovered, for example, is that diesel fuel supplies for freight trucking, which is the most harmful source of pollution for low-income communities of color, may be less responsive to cap-and-trade incentives because the political price of passing on diesel fuel trucking allowance costs to consumers is lower than the case for rising gas prices. So the ability for diesel upstream producers to pass along costs to customers is easier than it would be for other consumers that would be limited to passing along their gas, limited to passing along their increases to gas price increases. The other I think point to remember is the inadequate involvement of EJ groups in the policy process reflects this failure of democracy and bolsters the case for abandoning sector-specific carbon pricing policies for a comprehensive carbon fee, as was anticipated and proposed by the Climate and Community Investment Act, which many of the advocates that pushed for the CLCPA have likewise been pushing for a comprehensive economy-wide approach to generating fees for just transition investments, as opposed to a sector-specific approach like TCI, which has some of the challenges and disparities that I was just mentioning. And to just give one more example of this, if we look at, if we look at, oh, I'm sorry. I'll get back to this point in a second, but I think the important thing to remember is that when we looked at some of the debate that accompanied the Climate and Community Investment Act, there was some fear and some fear mongering that came from some of the folks who were opposed to it, claiming that if in fact we were to do an economy-wide polluter penalty fee, that cost might be passed along to consumers in the form of a gas tax. But unlike the Climate and Community Investment Act, which has a rebate program, which is designed to reduce the regressive impacts of potential gas tax, there's no provision in TCI that likewise can eliminate some of the regressive impacts of a gas tax. So for the folks who had a problem with the Climate and Community Investment Act potentially triggering gas taxes, even though that program clearly has a rebate program that would offset and in fact and not only make whole, but in some cases actually lead to a net increase for folks, we're actually talking about, you know, comparing of a system that has such a rebate structure built in to a TCI that has absolutely no ability to reduce its again regressive impacts. I think let me leave it there when it comes to TCI and talk for a second about clean fuel standard concerns. That was another area where we were, from a climate justice perspective, concerned, because we believe that allowing high carbon fuel producers to meet their credit obligations by paying clean producers for their energy is a weak way to enforce a standard. It lets them offset instead of eliminate their emissions, which by itself won't guarantee that emissions reductions and investments in overburdened communities will occur at the speed and scale required by the CLCPA, which in fact, I mean, one of the more unsettling arguments that you hear when people talk about low carbon fuel standard is this notion of, well, it's less polluting potentially than not having a low carbon fuel standard, which essentially means that communities that are disproportionately burdened with transportation emissions will continue to be disproportionately affected by transportation emissions, just a little less than we are now. And again, we submit to the Climate Action Council that, you know, baking in a system that, you know, clearly shows that there are disparities and that, in fact, there is, when we have the ability to look at, which is the next point that we raised in our critique, rather than looking at the need to electrify everything, we're being asked to potentially accept a system that would not get us the emissions reduction targets that electrifying everything would, which brings us to the next point, which is that clean air necessitates an electrify everything approach. Allowing vehicles to combust lower carbon fuel liquids still emits criteria pollutants, which won't eliminate air pollution hotspots. Next slide, please. The other, among the other points were that we recommend, and in fact, these were among the recommendations that somehow didn't make it through, I think, to the final Transportation Advocacy Panel recommendations, which is adopting a ZEV program like CARB for medium and heavy duty vehicles and carve out explicit targets for trucks and bus conversion that prioritize diesel emission reduction in air pollution communities overburdened by air pollution. We also believe that we have to mandate the rapid phase-in of the conversion of the state's fleet to zero emission vehicles and rapidly expand policies to encourage the uptake of electric vehicles, like incentives and enhancement or expansion of charging infrastructure. For example, as we just saw this week, last week in New York City, the first significant rollout of public charging infrastructure, including in neighborhoods like the South Bronx. I believe, Abby, that the next section goes back to you. So should I send it back to you?
Sure. Thanks, Eddie. So just a few more details about honing in on equitable vehicle miles traveled reduction. We have some strategies here. to suggest, such as establishing a New York State-supported equitable transit-oriented development effort via the Regional Economic Development Councils or a statewide program. And in terms of the affordable housing or development in general that happens along these transit-oriented development corridors, requiring that at least 20% be affordable housing, and amending the municipal home rule law to explicitly allow fees on new development to offset public transportation service costs, and requiring that at least 50% of transportation sector monies be spent on non-CARP programs. Lastly, in terms of supporting communities facing barriers, within the consolidated funding application of the Regional Economic Development Councils, mandating that prospective developers and employers identify how their prospective projects and related funding requests consider public transit options for low-income workers, and incentivizing hiring of disadvantaged workers in transit manufacturing by enabling companies to get a credit for setting aside a certain portion of their workforce for hiring them. So I will be passing on to Rawa here. In summary, you know, we need systemic change, as the Energy Efficiency and Housing Panel recommendations explicitly point out, and the transportation recommendations do not appear to achieve this. And though, as previously mentioned, the vague language and lack of detail and data make it difficult to meaningfully evaluate these recommendations, so we respectfully request that the transportation panel give it another go, ideally with more input from EJ groups, or at least more commitment to incorporating the feedback of EJ groups that they've already received. So thank you, and Rawa, take it away.
Great, thank you so much to my colleagues. My name's Rawa Gurmatsian. I'm the executive director of Push Buffalo, founding member of the New York Renew Steering Committee, as well as obviously representing the Climate Justice Working Group, and we are members of the Climate Justice Alliance. And if we can go to the next slide, please. I just, first of all, would like to start by thanking the Climate Action Council for hearing us out today. Obviously, I think that Elizabeth Jean-Pierre really gave us such an incredible overview for the lens that the Climate Justice Working Group has been approaching our commitment to this work and the implementation of the Climate Leadership and Protection Act. I also want to thank my colleagues, Eddie Bautista and Abigail, that really gave you a very high level, but also very specific ways that we had just an incredible amount of concerns for the transportation panel recommendations. And the reason for that is, collectively on the Climate Justice Working Group, we have decades and decades of lived experience, both many of us representing climate justice communities. We live in them, we work in them, we play in them. And, you know, really just having a deep understanding of what it's going to take. And what Elizabeth pointed out in particular of we needed the investments to be additive is that we've already been doing, you know, we've already been investing in these communities. And we know, in order to achieve the mandates of the Climate and Community Protection Act, that it has to be additive. And the other thing that I hope came out today is we really need to fundamentally shift how we do this work in order for us to be successful. And so I would also like to say that the Energy Efficiency and Housing Advisory Panel really, in our eyes, did an incredible job of being specific, of being comprehensive, and really you can tell the experience of the members of that group, having worked in EJ communities and had, I think, the greatest report that we saw on the recommendation side. So I'm just going to be reading for you really just kind of our concerns and suggestions to go even deeper on the recommendations that were presented by the Energy Efficiency and Housing Advisory Panel. So those concerns are to recognize that when you invest in a disadvantaged communities, that everyone around them benefits, and that it is imperative in order for a just transition to occur, which means that we know that this transition is inevitable, but justice is not. So how do we ensure that people that have been historically and currently underrepresented actually are represented, and the investments go there first, that we can quicken the pace and actually be successful in reaching the mandates and the goals of the CLCPA? So we should be aggressively pursuing established state goals. For example, New York State's own energy affordability goal of 6% or less of household income was not acknowledged in the report. So I think that should be inserted, emphasizing the just transition to greater effect. For example, regulatory action investments, inefficient appliances, and clean heating and cooling cooking must be front-loaded, and disadvantaged communities or poor and working class households will be left behind. Some of that work is already underfoot, and I can tell you from an organization that is beginning to do step, that the complexity of ensuring that low-income communities are able to transition is really difficult. So investments really need to go there to both educate the community and ensure that we can provide what they need to transition. Other things are sunset dates for combustion appliances and systems are inadequate without added goals to benefit disadvantaged communities. For example, by investing from proposed electrification and retrofit readiness fund, mandate utility planning for fossil fuel divestment and just transition investments, target workforce training and job creation, reduce cost burdens with adequate rate design in low-income households and historically redlined areas. Prioritize consumer financing options made available by CDFIs and credit unions as part of the Community Reinvestment Act Regulatory Compact. That includes providing technical assistance grant dollars to communities that have a vision for that transition. Consumer protection needs are generally inadequate, and so we're asking to update the recommendations to include utility customer bill of rights, including a safety and net style guarantee of renewable energy to every household, public education measures to counter power of IOUs and alleviate the opaqueness of the energy system, clawback provisions to defend against rate increases, gentrification and displacement are needed as part of public subsidies to provide to subsidies to private landlords. And I would also argue there needs to be an independent body that is ensuring that these clawbacks happen, because right now those provisions exist for many subsidies that the state provides, but that clawback feature is often not used. Energy benchmarks, disclosure requirements that protect and empower tenants with information about the energy use intensity and affordability of their housing stock. And we want to undertake the following additional actions. I think that there were, you know, I think it was implied, but not specific enough. So what we are asking is that these following actions be included in the energy efficiency recommendations: to create standards for upgrading existing buildings, include proper cost projection and place-based strategies for buildings in need of substantial repair or remediation, bolster local supply chains and create and job creation, outline plan for preservation, diversification, and growth of local supply chains and material and appliance distributors serving disadvantaged communities, heed the special needs of and jurisdictional issues of the state's public housing stock, in particular NYCHA and housing in New York City, tweak public service commission policies to encourage energy efficiency and additional funding as part of the rate base for energy efficiency, calculate costs and benefits holistically, consider the health impacts associated with poor indoor air quality and insufficient thermal comfort, incorporate the cumulative cost burden related to housing, energy, transportation, and healthcare. I'm going to leave it at that, and I hope that we will begin our conversation with any questions or comments that the CAC members will have for us. Thank you.
So now would be a good time if any of you have any questions for any of us.
Can you hear us?
We can hear you and we can see you.
Okay. Hi, everybody. It's Basil. Just a few quick questions. I'm sure other folks will have questions as well. Eddie, on the market-based mechanisms, your mention of the peer review study is helpful, and certainly experience elsewhere with the shortcomings or the failures of market-based mechanisms for environmental justice outcomes. It's good to hear your perspective on that. I'd be curious to hear from you if you saw in any of your research whether there were any regulatory or legislative potential fixes that would have made those programs a success, understanding that as you presented it, they hadn't worked for their intended outcomes. But I'm curious if there were any fixes to the systems that were created that would have actually made them work, as opposed to having them not work.
Hey, Basil, thanks for the question. What's interesting is that with California, they their cap and trade system, which really kind of kicked off in earnest in 2011, didn't capture transportation until 20. In other words, they didn't turn on cap and trade for transportation until 2015. So there's it's only now that the data is being crunched and analyzed. For example, one of the things that, and in fact, this is a study from the California Air Resources Board itself, showed that 1 year of data on transportation sector emissions showed increasing emissions from 2015 to 2016. The increase in transportation emissions was consistent with the 2.6% growth in vehicle miles traveled in California from 2015 to 2016. Which clearly more than offset any reductions in emissions attributable to fuel efficiency regs, if you want to make the case for cap and trade, or any other policy driver of reduced emissions. So I think that part of what we know doesn't work is if we're not getting a handle on vehicle miles traveled, what's the point if sprawl continues to be our development framework in New York State? In fact, just this weekend, the New York Times the New York Times editorial talked about how in Long Island you have this incredible built-in resistance to building multi-unit family housing and affordable housing, particularly around transit-oriented development like Long Island Railroad stations, as yet like another example of, if you want to deal with VMTs, you also have to deal with housing policies and development policies in the state. So, yeah, I think, Basil, like our approach is, which is the reason why a lot of the advocates were proposing an economy-wide comprehensive approach to revenue generating, one that has built-in protections for EJ and disproportionately burdened communities, like the Climate and Community Investment Act. We fear that a TCI regional approach that only looks at transportation and looks at it, again, inadequately, and looks at it in a way where there's no way to commit and actually, there's no way to, in a transparent public way for the state of New York to tell New Yorkers, yeah, whatever revenues we raise through TCI will not be spent for anything other than green. It's 10 years of Reggie have shown us that it is impossible. So yeah, for us, our range of solutions talks about the need for full electrification, mass investments in public transportation, and at the end of the day, having a more comprehensive approach than just a sectoral one on a regional basis that's largely unaccountable and untransparent for the average New Yorker.
Awesome. You had some follow-up question to that point?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Marie Therese Dominguez. Along those same lines, let me ask you a question about what you were just talking about with regard to funding in particular. So when the Transportation Advisory Panel looked at the TCI primarily as a mechanism, as you noted, for funding, particularly for funding for the EJ communities, and that would be the designated beneficiary, specifically for electrifying trucks, that are serving places like what you described, in other words, heavy truck areas, ports, et cetera, and really looking at, how do we expand public transit access for underserved communities. But let me ask you this, because I hear you loud and clear. What I'm trying to look at is if those types of spending priorities were able to be guaranteed, perhaps maybe through legislation, and to make sure that we actually, you know, could change our view about similar market-based programs. Like, would that be something that, have you looked at that? Or is that be, would that be something that would actually be, you know, a proposal that we could further discuss in terms of alternative proposals for funding for the investments? So, because I heard what you said about potentially aggregating the funds, our intent, I think from the Transportation Advisory Panel again, was to make sure that those dollars went specifically towards LMI communities. How do we make sure that those funds aren't raided, I think is the word that you used, by for other purposes? What is the mechanism by which we would potentially secure some of that funding?
Sure, and thanks for the question. And let me tweak the word raid appropriate to not offend anyone who may have been part of previous raids in the room. So I'll stop there. I think the problem is that I think the problem is that there is no way to guarantee that, right? Two quick things. One is, what's really been interesting to us is how recently the TCI proponents started talking about disproportionate impacts and trying to commit funding to again, environmental and climate justice communities. TCI has been talked about for at least 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe 3 years ago, the EJ communities got wind of it through some allies of ours and some of the environmental groups. And we looked into it, as we started raising these issues and these concerns, it was only late, probably in the last year, that, you know, all of a sudden environmental justice and disparities were rediscovered and all of a sudden placed front and center in the whole TCI conversation. And a cynical person would say that that only happened as a result of EJ groups across the Northeast starting to raise, you know, real technical and political questions with this approach. So I think one is this late blooming acknowledgement of EJ communities happened in year 10 of a 10-year TCI conversation. That said, putting cynicism aside, I don't know how you legislate what would be essentially a regional pact to do the kind of protection that one would like to see, say along the lines of what we did with congestion pricing, right? We all know that there is no, you know, airtight lockbox per se, but there's at least the ability to protect the revenues if you tie your revenues to bonding. And if you have to bond your revenues, the ability to be able to raid that and also be a serious player in the bond markets, you know, makes it a less likelier or makes it less vulnerable to the kind of raiding, appropriating that can happen. So I, if that were the case, I would imagine we would have legislated similar protections for RGGI a decade ago or 5 years ago. 7 or 8 years ago. So unless there are lawyers that can point the way that New York State legislature could put those kinds of limitations on a regional cap and trade program, and they've never done so for RGGI, I hear that it's not legally possible, but I would defer to others as to, you know, whether or not that is possible. I think the bottom line, I think the other thing that's most concerning to us is, you know, whether it's CARB's own research or other academic papers, the fact that we are playing market games at a moment when we all, I mean, look at some of the statistics that Elizabeth rattled off at the very beginning, right? And you would think that this would be an approach that some of the agency reps around the table would embrace. We need more command and control. We don't need, you know, at this moment of increasing climate urgency, to play the kind of market games that, you know, rely on incentives and allowances and auctions, when what we really need to be doing is talking about emissions reduction you know, across the board, which I thought was what the CLCPA envisioned in the first place, which is what created the Climate Action Council and the rest of us. So why we would double down on market gamesmanship as opposed to getting serious and recognizing that we've got to expand our command and control responses, not rely on market mechanisms that have largely failed us, I don't know why we would go down that road, but I'll stop there.
Yeah, Eddie, can I just add that we, as part of the Climate Justice Alliance, have been organizing against TCI in 11 states. These market mechanisms are grasshop solutions that have been offered by organizations that have fossil fuel companies on their boards of directors. And so the way that the problem, the black and brown problem, is solved is by throwing some money at us as if that's enough. It really is the most offensive way of thinking about communities of color, and particularly frontline people who have not only this TCI literally speaks against the spirit of CLCPA, which is about frontline solutions, where we're talking about investments, we're talking about infrastructure, we're talking about food sovereignty, we're talking about systems that are going to engage our communities in climate adaptation, mitigation, and resilience. And within that, we're also talking about mass surface transit and how that can help our communities. So this is really sort of an old school way of managing people of color by throwing some money at us and still benefiting fossil fuel companies that literally are part of these organizations that try to do an end run around us and have been meeting for 10 years without us until we made climate justice sexy, and then all of a sudden they needed to slap that on to an agenda that was created without us. So I have to say, just, you know, from the Climate Justice Alliance, from our perspective, we would definitely fight against any supporting TCI in the state of New York.
I appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
If I could also just add to both what Eddie and Elizabeth so eloquently said, and just to give a little bit of specificity, in particular around state agencies really needing greater coordination, because NYSERDA, for example, has provided some really amazing programs and that could benefit disadvantaged communities. But then we run up against some of the policies with the Public Service Commission, which I think, I think it's a fair statement to make, at least from my vantage point, that they've been much cozier with utilities. It has not been an open and transparent process. But even when we had the REF process and, you know, we were able to win community solar to make it easier for communities like ours to build the infrastructure to be able to then provide, you know, energy, reduce the energy burdens in our communities. You know, they came up with a very complicated feeder sort of proposal that absolutely makes no sense and adds just an enormous amount of complexity that's unnecessary. And of course, we're not dumb enough to not recognize that it is really not going to benefit communities like ours, that we will never be able to enjoy the benefits of energy burdens. We will never be able to own. We will never be able to maintain and distribute the power in our own communities that could actually generate community wealth and, you know, long-term create a more resilient community. So those are the kinds of examples where we would really love members of the CAC to look at what opportunities do the state agencies have for greater collaboration and coordination amongst each other that also remove barriers and provide additional supports for communities, but more importantly, also align all of y'all together to be more streamlined and actually adhere to the mandates of the CLCPA. Right now, you know, a lot of our time is being used, and we're happy to commit this time because we are here for our communities and we're here for everyday New Yorkers and we're here for the planet. But the reality is, even how we're receiving these recommendations are really confusing and difficult to understand. And what that is showing us is the infrastructure itself on the state agency side really needs to be fixed. Thank you.
While we have a quick pause, I wanted to acknowledge Rick Shengsky standing in for CEO Falcone, and then also acknowledge that we have a couple of virtual hands raised, Bob Howarth and Dennis Alsenbeck.
Okay, I think we had Ann want to say something.
Sure. Thanks so much. The question comment I had was directed at something Abby said, but it actually turns out to be very relevant to the last thing that Eddie said. First of all, I thought the presentation was great. A lot of great information. You can tell that you guys spent a lot of time combing through this, and it reminded me of things I now want to go back and take a second look at the transportation recommendations in more detail with this information in mind. But you mentioned, Abby, that you were dissatisfied with the focus on encouraging and incentivizing, and there wasn't enough limiting and, you know, more too much carrot and not enough stick. So this is where I want to go back and take a look, because my understanding of the recommendations were that by adopting California's ZEV requirements for light-duty vehicles, for medium-duty vehicles, and for heavy-duty vehicles, that we were actually talking about electrifying everything, and that it was command and control, that it was, and this is maybe an okay time to mention the legislation that passed this year, which is also, you know, phasing out the sale of internal combustion engine vehicles, and I hope the governor takes the opportunity to sign that legislation. So my view of the transportation recommendations overall was that there was this very strict command and control recommendation on the table, and all the rest of the stuff was enabling and paying for that. So, like, for example, I am supportive of TCI, but it's in the context of that command and control requirement being there as well. So I think that is the way we could avoid some of the problems we heard about from California. I think all of Eddie's concerns and criticisms of TCI are important and valid, but I'm hoping that the things that can be fixed as it's designed, and as if the design of TCI is changing in recent years as a result of this input and all the stakeholder meetings they having, I think that's a good thing. Maybe I'm less cynical, it's entirely possible. I can see how that would be frustrating, but if the program is changing to meet the requirements of the CLCPA to target those investment to disadvantaged communities, that strikes me as a positive development.
And just in direct response, I agree, but there's no way to guarantee the revenues. I mean, we need more than wishful thinking and good intentions. And there is no way that the Transportation Advisory Panel was unable, the TCI proponents, and you're one, or none of you have been able to articulate how you're going to protect the revenues. Rather, what's been happening lately is that our community's pain and disparities are being used to sell cynically a program that we all know cannot deliver deliver the revenues that it promises to deliver. So I'm not sure how to fix that. If structurally you cannot protect the revenues, then I don't know what there is to fix. It's a fatal flaw. Yeah.
I'm going to agree with you and say the same thing is absolutely true with any other money you appropriate through this legislature, through the CCIA, through any bills we haven't thought of yet. The funds can always be redirected, and that's a bummer.
Except,
but it's not
except
a reason
what you want.
To
except
not create a revenue stream to pay for the things that we all know we need, like transit-oriented development and public transit. We need a revenue stream to pay for that. Whether it comes through an economy-wide carbon price that's established by the legislature, or TCI that's then adopted by the legislature, it's all to the good, but we'd be fooling ourselves to think that one bill protects money in a lockbox and another doesn't. Because the legislature is the one that can always come back and change their mind, which they do pretty much every year about something.
I agree, and except I disagree that there aren't better ways of protecting. When you play in the bond markets, when you're bonding the revenue, you can't rate that. So yeah, there are protections that, because of the structure of TCI as a multi-state pact, doesn't lend itself to the greater protections that have been afforded through congestion pricing and the CCIA. So yeah, I said from I think the outset, there's no way to completely protect every dollar, but if you bond the revenue, it's certainly some protection and some ability to direct revenues in ways that TCI can't.
Thanks, Debbie.
Do we want to go to the raised hands?
Yes.
Do you guys think so?
We have one here in the room, okay. Janet Joseph, on behalf of CEH.
Hi, thank you very much for your thoughtful comments. This is on behalf of the EEH panel. The very first comment on the slide here speaks to creating standards for upgrading existing buildings. We welcome a little more elaboration or texture on what the working group is trying to get to with that point. We try very much to get to the existing building stock. I think what you're pointing to here are all of those buildings in disrepair, but we'd like to understand a little bit more about how you see those standards potentially playing out.
Can we pull up the slide that she is referring to? I'm sorry.
I think it's the first bullet on the slide that is displayed.
Okay.
The one that starts with create standards.
Okay. Does anyone want to answer that question? Can you project? Because I can barely hear you. I'm sorry. I heard Elizabeth.
So Elizabeth, Janet Joseph had asked a question about the first bullet on the slide in front and was asking for slightly more clarity or explanation as to what you meant by that.
I'm happy to answer some of that. I think it can go a little bit deeper, but as folks that have been doing energy efficiency upgrades, I think it is really important to also look at this regionally. For example, we included NYCHA and housing and public housing in New York City as being priority areas. I can speak to the upstate New York region where we have the second oldest housing stock. I think it's really important that we expand and actually do building projections for what it means to do weatherization and green efficiency work. And some of that expansion has to include things like mold remediation. For us here, lead remediation is really important because we don't want to, button down a home and make people even sicker because there's other toxins that are in the home. Additionally, some of these old public housing units really need so much remediation and maintenance and upgrades in order for them to actually function sufficiently and get them prepared not only for reducing their energy consumption, but actually preparing them to produce energy through new systems like heat pump technology, as well as rooftop solar and other solar options that would be available to them.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. Now we'll go to virtual hands, Bob Howard.
Yes, thank you. Thank you to the panelists. I applaud your presentations. They're very thorough, very convincing, very thoughtful. I agree with much of what you've said. I have two specific questions, one for Abigail and one for Eddie. Abigail, I agree with you that the energy efficiency and housing panel report was easier to follow than the transportation in terms of reaching our goals and deadlines. You specifically talked about the transportation panel probably not setting up a path to get us to the 2050 goal. I'm also deeply concerned about getting us to the 2040 goal, which of course is to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions by 40%. And neither the energy efficiency or transportation panel got us anywhere close to that, although the energy efficiency panel came closer and I think personally has a tougher challenge. given the housing stock. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on how much emphasis we should be putting on the 2040 goal versus the longer term goal. And then my question for Eddie, as you probably know, at least some of the leadership in the assembly put off taking a stand on the CCIA, saying they wanted input from the Climate Action Council. And I'm wondering specifically what you would recommend to us. Are the aspects of the CCIA as written, is that what you would propose that we endorse, or are there the ways to improve it further? Again, thank you to both of you.
Eddie, you want to...
you guys want me to start? Yeah. Thanks for the question, Bob. I think here's what's so attractive about CCIA, right? It's economy wide, and by establishing a polluter penalty fee of, I believe, $55 per ton, and including co-pollutants, right? We'd be first of all addressing emissions reduction, not just when it comes to climate change, but also the more troubling public health compromising and pollution emissions that so burden EJ communities. The CCIA, based on our projections, would generate something on the order of $15 billion a year. And when estimates of what New York State what sorts of revenues New York State requires to meet the goals of the CLCPA, I've seen estimates as high as $30 billion a year. So $15 billion doesn't cover it all, but it gets us, it's a nice step in that direction, right? Can the CCIA be improved? I think that there is... A certain level of humility that advocates have, that I think that, yeah, we believe that probably all pieces of legislation could probably be improved. But and not to bash our friends in the assembly, in order to improve a piece of legislation, you actually have to have a dialogue. You have to have a hearing. You have to, like, there was absolutely no engagement of CCIA, and to put off to the CAC, it just didn't register with us. We didn't see the need to delay another year for the CAC to arrive at a series of systems and projects and initiatives to get us without coming up with the money. Like, that's not, is the CAC prepared to, the only, I think, revenue generating mechanism that I've seen put before the CAC, aside from the Climate and Community Investment Act, is TCI, right? I'm not sure what it is we would wait for the CAC. I would invite the CAC to take a long, hard look at the legislation. And in fact, if there are improvements to be made, if there's input or feedback to be shared, I know New York Renews and our allies would love to hear it. But frankly, the people who need to hear it are the Assembly and State Senate leadership, right? So, at the risk of punting, Bob, I feel like that response was a legislative punt, right? To kind of wait till the CAC comes up with recommendations when you only have two revenue generating proposals that I think you guys are looking at writ large, it feels dodgy to me.
I don't entirely disagree, but since it's been punted to us, I'm just, we're looking for the best way forward at this point in time, right? So, but thank you for that.
And Bob, I appreciate the question about whether, kind of prioritizing that 2040 goal and focusing on that makes sense. And I would say yes, and that we need to resist the temptation to kick the can down the road, similar to what Eddie was just saying. Not only because of the threat of climate change and the tipping points that we are facing, but also because communities are suffering. And we have such opportunity to improve people's lives right now by making smart investments. So I would say yes, like the sooner the better, of course. And I would just ask if, you know, any of my other fellow climate justice working group members want to weigh in on this, because it's an excellent question.
Yeah, this is Sonal. I'm the director of policy at We Act for Environmental Justice. Hi, everyone. And I just want to emphasize what Abigail just said. And I think Rawa had mentioned this before, but as a group that is working on actual implementation of energy efficiency, retrofitting, weatherization work in low-income multifamily buildings, it's very difficult. It's very difficult work. And so it's important that we start now and set really strong standards that to happen sooner to actually make those mechanisms happen faster. I think it's this idea of kicking the can down the road. We're going to hit 2050 and have a lot of interventions to do that are really complicated that we haven't figured out yet. So I do think putting emphasis really on both timelines, but not forgetting that earlier timeline, is really, really vital for hammering out the complicated matter that is how to do this work for people that can't afford it up front.
Thank you. That's great.
Dennis Elsenbeck, you had your hand up.
Yes, thank you. Thank you to the panelists. Appreciate this level of feedback. You know, what maybe I'm missing that this group maybe could help out a little bit, and I think, Abigail, you touched it when you started to point out the differences, urban versus rural, and then neighbor-to-neighbor, community-to-community. CLCPA is very high-level goals, and what I think we got to get back down to is kind of like looking at the objectives from a challenge opportunity point of view, but location specific. And so, you know, having your thoughts on, you know, defining benefit location based really would be much more helpful, simply because we got the recommendations and then we make indications that, well, some of them are falling short of what? I mean, what is that goal? What is that objective? What is the definition of benefit? Because I have communities coming to me, especially communities that are in coal plant, and they say, well, no one's ever talking about coal plants anymore because we're worried about the peaker plant. So I just hear thoughts on, you know, can we get down to more definition, location-based definition of what is meant by benefit in terms of what the objectives are? I'm not sure if that is the right question to ask you guys, but that's where you're losing me a little.
Go ahead, Eddie. Yes, thank you.
Thanks for that, Dennis. I mean, I think that, in fact, that is part of the charge of this group, right? Like, we are active trying to figure out what benefits mean. We're working on it. Like, don't despair. I will say, though, that the original version of the climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, when it was the Climate and Community Protection Act, never said benefits. We talked about direct investments. Like, this addition of benefits was a late hour addition during the final negotiations for this bill. And we warned our partners at the negotiating table that this moment would come. Like, how do you define benefits? It doesn't make, without any sort of clarity, even in the legislation. And we in fact said, not only do the advocates, but we suspect agency people, whether they're heads or frontline agency staff, would probably prefer investments. 35% of investments, which is transparent, open, publicly accountable. Everyone could find out whether or not we're hitting those targets. But the insertion of benefits was not our doing. And now we're trying to play the hand we've been dealt, Dennis. But we agree, benefits was a really unfortunate addition, and it wasn't ours.
I appreciate that candor, actually. It's the reason why I ask these type of questions is that there are unintended consequences when we just follow high-level goals, one of which is this idea of electrify everything. And it's an interesting concept, but you know, you're assuming that the utility systems can actually accept that. And if we assume that, we're in trouble. So we have to think about this in context of, I like the idea of it more being an investment because it leads to different business models that we can talk about that incentivizes someone to do the right thing, whether it's the neighborhood, the utility, an investor, or otherwise. And I appreciate that, Eddie, because I just think that's what I think the Climate Action Council will be discussing a lot. It's not just the recommendations, is what do you think the outcome will be? Because I unfortunately, I've done this too long, and I've seen kind of like this full circle of this cyclic view. We did it in the 80s with the 6-cent law, and now we're looking at a different version of this. So, you know, keep trying, please, Eddie, and your team. It would be incredibly helpful if we looked at it through your eyes, in the eyes of each neighborhood to the degree that we can. Thank you.
I don't know if any of my colleagues has any. I don't want to keep talking, folks. I'm really sorry, but I did have one quick little response to Dennis, unless anyone else had something to say from Climate Justice Working Group.
Go ahead, Eddie.
Yeah, thanks. I think that part of Dennis, part of what we have, and I think Abigail touched on it early on, but it's a theme that we have seen throughout the working groups and the advisory panels, which is we feel like there was an emphasis in some of the, maybe almost all the working groups, on the parts of the economy that are the parts that are not there yet, right? We feel, whether it's the energy efficiency and intensive uses or some of the others, but we believe that some of the working groups missed an opportunity to do exactly what we're, electrify everything requires the kind of commitment some of the recommendations that we were making both in our group and within these panels that were not taken up, and they were in fact spending more time on things like green hydrogen, which is not there yet, right? It's a frustration I think some of us have found, which is rather than look at how we get to the 85%, which is the bulk of the CLCPA, there was too much emphasis on that 15% that's not there. So I'm with you. I think we could have done a lot better and more work in some of these working groups had we focused on the 85% total emissions reduction rather than the 15%. But yeah.
I agree with that, by the way.
And now I believe we have Rose Harvey has her hand up, as well as Peter Ivanowitz.
Hi. This is Rose Harvey, and I don't have my video on because I have limited connectivity, and it's a little better when I don't have my video on. First of all, I just want to thank you all for the presentation, specificity. You clearly went through everything. It was really superb and informative. And I have two questions. One, Elizabeth, you said something that really resonated with me about, well, what happens if we set it up and we set some action up and then nothing happens? What do we do about that? And that's pretty easy to do, particularly in the long term, and particularly when administrations change. You can make promises, and if they don't happen, it doesn't matter because you're not there anymore. So I would love just feedback if you kind of have any examples of or just thoughts on what we could do to increase accountability. And the second goes a little bit with the last discussion, which is maybe we could get to a level of specificity on where investment or benefits are specifically in disadvantaged communities by just setting up pilots, which are the first to get the investment or, you know, whatever that may be, so that not to test something that's new, but to actually invest in something which already exists, as Eddie was saying earlier. So just your comments on both of those.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the first part of the question is definitely hard. How do we sustain and monitor whether or not this is working? Remember, we're going into a field where not only is climate change unpredictable, but what we're attempting to do and create is also a test of trying out new ideas and new things. And so it is difficult. But I think that's the reason why we wanted, that's one of the reasons we wanted to pass the CCIA, because we actually have to legislate, some of these protections. But you're absolutely right. It's going to take, some kind of cultural shift within governance, to make a commitment, to making sure that this is sustained in the long term, to create timelines, short term and long term timelines. But we have the same questions too. In terms of the pilots, that's actually an easier part because there is work that is happening all over the state. There are investments that are being made. I can use offshore wind in Sunset Park as an example, where NYSERDA invested $200 million in bringing offshore wind to South Brooklyn. That's an investment in infrastructure that will bring us renewable energy, will bring us green jobs, and will also address the issue of residential and economic displacement on an industrial waterfront. And so it shows you how it checks all the boxes, including health and health disparities, because we know that polluting infrastructure has a lot to do with the fact that so many of our communities were impacted by COVID and will be affected by extreme weather events. So there are projects, and the thing that we've been talking about at New Yorker News, for example, is what are the projects that exist in urban communities? What are the projects that exist in rural communities? Looking at the topography so that we are addressing a host of difference throughout the state, and supporting the variety of interventions in communities that are very different from each other because of where they're located. So that's definitely something that could be really exciting, and creating and investing in projects also that are replicable, that we can then learn from and replicate in other places, because this is not the time for us being NIMBY. This is really the time for us to start investing in interventions that are replicable.
And so we could take for each sector and each place where we're seeing either work already in place and beginning, and have these pilots for various problems, and set them up, and then at least we know the first investments are going in the communities that need them the most.
If I could add one other thing to what is being said, yes, everything to what Elizabeth said, but also we really want to get away from kind of the scarcity mentality between communities and create a spaciousness and an abundance that we are not competing, we are collaborating. And so, how are we also thinking about, ensuring that funding is going to go into some kind of pot, right, that communities can access, and that there is time for planning, and then they don't have to fight for the resources. The resources will be there once their plans are done. It also encourages, as Elizabeth was saying, this opportunity. It's, what they're doing in Sunset Park is really replicable, and all the learnings that they've had can then be, shared with these other communities. I think is really critical and really important. And there are already many places that are beginning to demonstrate that. So how do we, again, I think it's really taking away the competitiveness is going to be critical if we actually want these interventions to happen at the pace that we need them to.
Rose, we should be focused on how collectively we are strengthening social cohesion across the state by investing in different infrastructure projects.
Right. So thank you very much. And thank you for all your work. This was great.
Peter Iwanowicz?
Hi, thanks, Sarah. I appreciate it. Wow, thank you all for this sort of powerful discussion and the time and energy you put into looking at the panel recommendations thus far. I don't know when our next meeting with you is scheduled, but I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on the other panel recommendations as well as the ones you've presented today. But just, you know, there are 20 million people who live in New York have no idea of how important this dialogue today has been to them, their lives, and the future generations of New Yorkers. And we owe you a debt of gratitude and deep thanks for the time and energy you've spent looking at these panel recommendations. So I have one further recommendation before I get to a couple questions. Eddie had mentioned some peer review studies at the beginning of his talk. I would love for those to be forwarded along with these slides and appended to the slides so that when we post the materials for this publicly, that those reports are out there. I think they're really important for people to understand the studies that have gone forward in other places where these market-based solutions have been put forward. And, you know, the research that Eddie had there, it really talks about the failings of these policies. I think that's just really important to the overall dialogue as we as a council, you know, get to the point of shaping what our draft scoping plan is. So I hope that's an okay request, and I hope we can do that because I think it's really important. To my questions, I have two of them, and I'll just put them on the table and just then I'll step back and listen. The first one I have is low carbon fuel standards. I'm not sure if you got into this that directly, Eddie, but when you look at the Climate Leadership Community Protection Act, of which our deliberations are sort of grounded in statute, does a policy like a low carbon fuel standard fit within the bounds of the statute? Or do you guys think it's outside of the bounds of the statute and should not be a panel recommendation, aside from the fact that it's a market-based mechanism that your organization and others oppose? So that's one question I have. The second question is for Elizabeth and Rawa. I would love to just hear you expound a little bit more on what you were just talking about of these replicable solutions that are out there. And Elizabeth, I think you recommended at the very beginning of your talk with that PowerPoint slide of how to inject just transition into the scoping plan. And I think this is where, for us as a council, it probably gets real. And I'll preface this by this way of saying that there are a lot of people of color in this state and elsewhere across this world who, you know, based on the historic failings of government and I would just say intentional harm, anybody that hasn't read The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein probably should and understand what I'm talking about in terms of intentional harm. But based on that, what should the council be doing to sort of understand the success that's happening in communities related to just transition so that as we inject it, hopefully, into the scoping plan, we understand how to do it and do it well based on that perspective of people of color.
So Peter, I will take a shot at this question. And Eddie, if you could just hold off on the low carbon standard, that would be great. So in a community like Sunset Park, that is in New York City's largest significant maritime industrial area, we have spent generations fighting against the siting of power plants, the thousands of cars that go through the Gowanus Expressway, the waste transfer stations, all of the clunky polluting infrastructure that has contributed to our health disparities, to early death, to the fact that we were disparately impacted by COVID, right? And in the process of fighting against something, we started envisioning what the industrial waterfront could be. And so what we call it is, and this is important because it is a waterfront, it is an industrial waterfront that can have regional impacts that can build for climate adaptation and mitigation. And so when we envision the waterfront, we look at a waterfront where already we have operationalized community-owned solar initiative, offshore wind. We're working with the New York City Economic Development Corporation to bring in an eco-industrial hub. We are thinking, how do you take a lands that doesn't exist anywhere. You know, New York City real estate is almost unavailable, right, for building things. All we have is the industrial waterfront. So the industrial waterfront then becomes the vehicle for addressing our climate change needs. It's an economic vehicle, it's a health, it's an economic justice vehicle. And it also has regional impacts. And so even in New York, where we are building really quickly, where would we get our materials? We would get it from the industrial waterfront. So that cement could go towards permeable surfaces. If we were strengthening the subway system, those materials would come from our industrial waterfront. And our industrial waterfront is also a way of connecting to upstate. And we can envision food sovereignty connecting our densely urban community to economically depressed farmers upstate, where the food can come through refrigerated barges to our waterfront and distribute healthy food to our communities. That is at the heart of that is social cohesion. How are we investing in infrastructure in a community where not only will they get jobs and it'll prevent displacement, but it will be jobs that are going to address future climate needs. And so that can only happen in the industrial waterfront, and that's why we call it a green reindustrialization. And so even taking down the peaker plants and replacing them with energy storage, there are so many possibilities for renewable energy, for food sovereignty, and for connecting New York City, which is which is an island, to those resources and these industrial waterfronts. And those things are replicable. And you go to our website; it's called The Grid, and you could read about it. I think we have something like an 80-page report that describes this vision that not only uses the Climate Mobilization Act in New York, but the CLCPA. And then on a national level, we're working really hard to bring resources through a Green New Deal and through Thrive so that there are investments in our community. In fact, tomorrow, the Secretary of Energy is coming to Upbrook to talk about what those investments might look like. So I just want you to move away from thinking about communities of color as being sort of the passive recipients of other people's good intentions, and really thinking about how we are the drivers of transformation on infrastructure, on food sovereignty, on legislation, on community building. And so everyone here has to be part of that leaderful approach to thinking differently about governance and about investments in communities that are frontline communities, because they don't just benefit the local community. They have impacts that go beyond that community. I hope that I answered that. I'm pretty certain I left a bunch of stuff out, but I want to stop because I don't want to talk too long.
Yeah, I'd love to hear, Rob, or your perspective, because I know there's some stuff going on the ground in the western part of the state too, and this is a statewide law. So if you could just give us some repeat the success from your perspective too, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. And Peter, thank you so much for asking that question. Elizabeth, thank you always for, you know, both framing it and then going down to the grassroots level. And we operate from a framework of nothing about us without us is for us, right? And so I think the idea is oftentimes when we talk about disadvantaged communities that we don't have the answers and solutions. And I work in a frontline EJ community that is post-industrial city, just a couple of miles. I can walk to the Peace Bridge from my office. And so we are dealing with the threats of like our historic legacy, but also trying to revive our economy and being the third poorest city in America. Yet Bush Buffalo is a national and international model for our place-based work. I encourage all of you to come see it. And our community is thinking very holistically about it. And our solutions really come from the ground. They come from the people that have been underrepresented and sort of left behind, to ask them, imagine, you know, if we had all the resources, what would this community look like? What is it that you want and need where you live? And so that is what we've been building over the last 16 years. I'm going to talk about two really amazing projects. One is because I also want to highlight that HCR, which we love, and I know that the chairwoman is on this call, and just want to say I'm so grateful and thank you for funding our next housing project, which we started community planning with the community as the CLCPA, formerly CCPA, was being written, to ask them if this legislation were to pass, You know, these are all the things that would be available to our community. So let's just build it, because we want to show that we can do this for ourselves, right? And so we're going to build 49 units of affordable and supportive housing, 30% supportive for the hardest population to house, which are people that are dealing with chronic mental health, chronic addiction, and facing homelessness. It's a workforce opportunity. And there's going to be no fossil fuel infrastructure. We're also doing 2 rehabs, 10 new builds, and then thinking through other kinds of amenities like public green spaces for children and for adults, thinking about food producing community gardens and what is a food desert. And so these things are possible. Not only did people tell us that this was an impossible task, but we actually planned it and came up with really creative ways of working with designers and planners that didn't know how to make this project happen for a community like ours. I'm not going to share all those details with you. The other one is we are working with 40 low income and really poor communities, 20 households in North Harlem, which we act working on, and 20 in Western New York and the West Side community, where folks living in subsidized housing and affordable housing are being transitioned from gas stoves to induction ovens. We are providing, we're doing air quality monitoring. We're going to be gauging the increase of people's utility bill, in particular their electric bill. We are providing heat pumps as well as all new, you know, induction ovens, pots and pans, and also doing cooking demonstrations with them. And we will know within the next year exactly what the cost of implementing the CLCPA for the most disadvantaged communities and households will look like, including cost estimates. So WEAC's pilot location is actually in a public housing, and I think it's NYCHAR is where you're doing it. And on the west side of Buffalo, it's going to be affordable housing that we've built and pushed. So just to tell you that we are already demonstrating what these things can look like. We are dealing with permitting and, you know, codes and all of those sort of like crazy challenges. And to say what is happening in multi-dwelling communities in New York City are going to be very different challenges that we face right here in upstate New York. But that creating some kind of a study to remove the barriers, as I say, and also create the supports is going to be critical in implementing the CLCPA. And so how do we create better communication with state agencies to help us do that in real ways is going to be critical over the next few years.
Thanks for that. I don't know. Tremendous stories. And my personal takeaway is that, you know, us in the council and people across New York State should spend some time really listening to communities and understanding what the community wants their vision to be, rather than them applying for potential pots of money that might be available for something that might not fit with what their vision is. So that's really, really, thank you both for your work and help there. I just had that one lingering request about low carbon fuel standard. I don't know if you're ready to jump in, Eddie.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Let me preface this by saying I'm not an attorney. So, however, my sense of low carbon fuel standards is that, in fact, that fuel is, in fact, prohibited by CLCPH, specifically for the section that really kind of defined and narrowed the universe of offset style programs and sources. Specifically, I think what comes to mind is with low carbon fuel standard dependence on biofuels, and they thought biofuels were not considered renewable and therefore not acceptable as an offset under CLCPA. But I'll defer that to the lawyers in the room about whether or not I'm unnecessarily narrowly interpreting it. But I thought it was pretty clear that low carbon fuel standard is in fact not low carbon fuels are not fuels that the CLCPA envisioned as to deploy to reach the emissions reduction targets that the law envisions.
Thanks, Eddie, for that input.
So this has been a really great exchange and discussion, and I hate to cut it off, but we are about 25 minutes over what we planned for the full meeting. We did have left an update on the disadvantaged communities criteria, that Rosa Mendez was going to provide. And so I guess we have a couple options. We could turn to that and power through it, or we could save it for the next meeting, and perhaps I can open it up to the members to see what their preference is. I know there was a specific request from one council member that we provide this update, so I want to make sure that we're being considerate of that. I can't see hands, so if folks want to speak up.
So I just assume get the update.
All right. I will also say the update sounds good if folks are able to see them.
Can I make one closing comment on the prior? Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay, so this is Marie Therese Dominguez. I just wanted to, before we move on, and I realize we're going to get a quick update here, I just wanted to, because I didn't before take the opportunity to say thank you, very, very much to the Climate Justice Working Group. You all have done a remarkable amount of work, and we very much appreciate the thoughtful suggestions, insights that you've shared, as well as recommendations that you've put forward. There is an enormous amount of work behind all of the work that you've done, and we would very much like to make sure that we continue the engagement and further make sure that you can see some of the work that I think the Transportation Advisory Panel has done, because I think the summaries are at a very high level, but I do think it's worth actually doing further consultation and making sure that we're getting down to the nitty-gritty, especially given the substantive nature of a number of the recommendations that you put forward. So I look forward to coordinating that and moving that forward, but just wanted to say again, thank you very much.
Thank you. So if we can advance to the next slide, maybe two slides forward, and we can have Rosa Mendez give an update on the disadvantaged communities criteria.
Hi, everyone. This is Rosa Mendez from DEC, and I'll try to be very quick. As you can tell, the working group has been putting in a tremendous amount of work, not only reviewing the panel recommendations, but also on developing the criteria for disadvantaged communities. And this started, of course, with exploring other examples that are available in other jurisdictions, such as California and the EPA's EJ screen. And they also discuss what criteria or indicators should be used and develop a universe of what those criteria and indicators could be. We also use an evaluation rubric as a way to help us make sure that the criteria or indicators that we're moving forward with align with the Climate Act and also have the kind of data quality and integrity that would be most useful for this kind of action. Where we are now is continuing to develop the draft criteria, including the indicators, and looking at methodology for how to combine those criteria in order to identify or designate communities, and also working on documentation of the work to date and of the data sets that are being included. Where we are heading is to a public comment process for 3 months, and that will include at least 6 public hearings. And our goal is to have the finalized criteria by November. And if we can move to the next slide, we have a little bit of a description of how we got where we are. The criteria development involves the expertise of the working group, of course, and it's also being supported by a state staff team. Represented by many state agencies and 2 consultants. So during the first phase, we were looking at criteria and indicators for selection. And I mentioned earlier that our evaluation rubric focused on alignment with the Climate Act. And as I'm sure you're aware, the Climate Act provided 3 groups of categories for this disadvantaged communities definition, and that includes areas burdened by cumulative environmental pollution that can lead to health impacts, socio and economic demographics, and areas vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. So our universe included around 150 indicators that we considered. 90 were assessed with data, and 50 were identified as priority for inclusion. So next is the methodological or scoring approach. And this refers to how we combine or group the indicators and how to score to develop a composite score and how to apply geographically so that we can identify or designate communities as disadvantaged communities. We also have grouping of data, weighing or scoring. And along every step of the process, you'll see that we are ground truthing with the working group as a way to ensure that the methods and indicators reflect their on-the-ground expertise. And we can move to the next slide, please. So as you can see from the ground truthing, this is an iterative process where we are learning and adjusting as we go from feedback. Where we are now is testing these iterations and getting more ground truthing from the working group to move us into the next phase. So we'll just go quickly to the last slide for our next step. And where we are now is we are working with the Climate Justice Working Group to review and ground truth of draft scenarios. So a scenario would be a scenario of how to group the indicators and how to score to get to a geographic designation. We are preparing to incorporate new state data that we are receiving from DEC, Department of Health, and also from climate analysis. And we are iterating and going to reach consensus on the criteria and indicators and the scoring approach. We're also continuing with documentation, and all of that documentation is going to help us as we move into the public engagement process, including at least 6 public meetings. So that was very quick, but happy to answer any questions on that, and happy to also come back and give further updates.
Great. Thank you, Rosa. Farah, do we have any raised hands virtually?
I am not seeing any at the moment.
All right. So if we can transition to the next slide, then. That brings us to the end of what we plan to cover today. Our next council meeting is scheduled for July 22nd, starting at 2:00, and we'll begin hearing about the integration analysis. Barring any unforeseen circumstances, that meeting as well as future meetings will be held in person, but we'll also maintain webcast broadcast to allow for broad participation. And we'll also be working with the Climate Justice Working Group to arrange additional opportunities for them to come back before the council to provide feedback on the additional panel's recommendations. So with that, thank you to the members of the Climate Justice Working Group. We appreciate you being here with us today, and look forward to having you participate in future meetings with us.
So, Sarah, this is Peter Armano. It's just a quick, I heard you right. The next meeting will be the 22nd. There won't be additional meetings in between with the Climate Justice Working Group, but maybe thereafter.
So, we're currently coordinating with them, and we had offered a potential to tack on some additional time for them at the July 22nd meeting. I think they wanted to see how this one went, and then we were gonna regroup. So it's possible that we will have additional feedback at the July 22nd meeting. It's also possible that we'll be looking to schedule an additional meeting in August. So it's a little bit up in the air right now, but we're committed to making sure that we do get their feedback to the council here. So we'll work with them on that.
Okay. Thanks, Sarah. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Right. And Sarah, if I could ask, this is Raya Salter, will be the process for iterating with this, with the Climate Justice Working Group on the plan itself? And also, if the disadvantaged communities criteria is supposed to debut in August, then I'm trying to, where is, again, that process piece before they're debuted for the Climate Justice Working Group to you know, advise this body and others and provide feedback as to that process as well. So those two overarching process questions regarding iteration on the plan itself and iteration on the recommendations that are coming out very, very soon for the disadvantaged communities.
Sure. So some of this is, you know, we're working through it to some degree in real time because there are a number of work streams that that are coming together. We do, I think that getting the feedback on the recommendations from the Climate Justice Working Group is a starting point. And I think when we have our integration analysis discussions, there's potential for additional feedback, you know, throughout the end of or throughout the remainder of this year and in development of the draft scoping plan. So some of the details we really need to iron out, but we are aware of the tight time frame and everything we're trying to get in here, and we're working to try to make it be as seamlessly integrated as possible for all of you.
And we definitely appreciate that, but time is literally, we're speaking, you know, just a few weeks. In the first instance, and I know that I and others have asked for, you know, some of this data for this piece and the plan more broadly, you know, for more information about the process, for more information about the inputs, so that this could be an iterative process. And I'm at this point very concerned that there is no process for this iteration. You know, I understand that it's a lot of information, but that I just really ask what the process will be for that iteration to make sure that it happens, given that we're talking about weeks.
Yeah. So apologies if it sounds like we don't have a plan. I mean, we are developing the plan. We have the meetings for July and September and October. We're starting to map those out to have discussions of the results of the integration analysis. And I would expect that will inform a lot of the thinking and discussion what will then go into the draft scoping plan. So I do think the next several meetings where we actually, you know, are digging into the results of the integration analysis and discussing what the implications of that are, I think that will be a big part of the process to incorporate in the feedback of the council.
All right. I do understand the challenge, and I think that there must be an iteration mechanism scheduled now, because we are looking at both these disadvantaged communities criteria and a draft plan coming out in a matter of months, and we have to schedule and figure out what that iteration is going to look like. And I think the Climate Justice Working Group, the time ran out, what spectacular, crystal clear feedback, both substantive praise and also evidence-backed critiques, significant critiques, including a request that the transportation panel give it another go. So, you know, and I did hear there's going to be some productive iteration there between that panel, but, you know, there's some very significant adjustments that I hear will need to be made if true iteration is going to happen. And I think that needs to be scheduled now.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. This is Doreen. We'll take a look at how these pieces fit together. And Sarah, if you think it's possible, let's just send an email to the council members with sort of the agenda by month.
Okay, sure.
And overlay the schedule of the Climate Justice Working Group within that. Thank you.
Thank you, Raya. This is Peter for bringing up those points. Very important.
Good. Great. So we'll see you all next time. And we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.